We are super happy for all the support we got, and it's really unbelievable to have a nearly hour-long podcast on formal sciences with two unexperienced hosts and have like this growth. So if we extrapolate from that, and in the first 3 months, we grew by a factor of infinity because we started from zero, we will be at like very large cardinals in the next year. So that's good. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this slightly non-standard episode of About Logic, because season one is over. We had 10 guests, 10 conversation interviews, whatever you want to call it. It was a great time. And we are really happy how this was perceived, how many of you joined, listened, the positive comments, the support from the community. We had people sharing the result on X. And under this impression, let us maybe start with something. There will be another season. There will be season two starting in 2 weeks. But for today, we wanted to recap shortly what happened in season one. And to do so, maybe let me list a few facts. The first season was supported by the Akademie der Wissenschaften in Hamburg, the Academy of Sciences and Humanities in Hamburg. And we are super grateful for that. And as I mentioned, given the positive feedback, we want to continue with season two. Then without that support, so for that reason, we will add a small donation link, Buy Me a Coffee, to cover costs below. So if you have some money to spend, feel free to do that, but don't feel obliged. This will continue in any case for a while. So don't be too worried. Then I should mention we have over 1,000 subscribers, and we are super grateful for that. And everybody who hasn't subscribed yet but listens should feel bad, because it's the subscribers who keep us motivated. So you do not need to feel bad.
You can also subscribe and don't listen. That's fine. That's fine.
Yeah, that's also fine. You can also just play the video in the background and go to sleep. We are fine with all that.
It's actually good to go asleep. No, that's the famous statistics that listen to About Logic videos is very good if you have sleeping issues. Yeah.
Actually, I'm one of these people. I mean, not with About Logic, because my own voice is horrible for me, but I'm always listening to podcasts, and sometimes my wife hates me for that. I have it too loud, but normally within ears, it works. We have over 2,000 hours of watch time. That's insane for us. I mean, literally days and days of people watching the interviews and the content. All in all, for us, it looks like a great success. And before talking about season two, we wanted to clarify a few questions that were raised in the comments. So let me forward them to Thorsten, because most of them are more on the constructive side of things, I would say.
So not on the destructive Thorsten, side?
If you ask Hilbert, that's the same. That's actually one comment that we oversimplified, that Hilbert Brauer problematics, but that's maybe for another episode. So let me first say, Thorsten, do you want to say anything that I haven't mentioned so far among the thank yous?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really cool to see this sort of audience engagement, that the people really interested commenting, asking questions. I mean, we try to respond to them, but sometimes we may miss something because maybe we're just distracted. But in general, I think we had some good and interesting discussions, and it's good to see that people are sort of not just sort of watching it, but are actually engaged. So I find this is really good. And actually, I mean, I'm enjoying doing this and getting some sort of feedback. I mean, especially positive feedback, but also critical comments and remarks or suggestions. We should interview, for example, somebody said we should interview Joel Humpkins, and we have. I mean, he is coming up, and other people O. Schreiber, I think, also was mentioned, and we also interviewed him. So talked to him. So that's very good. There was a bit of a controversial discussion that people said, okay, I'm pushing too much for sort of like this constructive angle. And I think that's true. I think in some cases, I was really going for it and maybe didn't give our guest enough time to expand their ideas. But I think in the end, having a bit of controversy is actually making the sort of the podcast more lively. So I don't think I'm going to give up on asking people about intuitionism. But I take on board that obviously we should be, I mean, allowing people to expand themselves. And also that's not, obviously it's not the only issue we are interested in.
No, that's probably a good statement. So you already replied to one of the comments I wanted to ask you about, but there were a few more formal questions. So let me ask you about that. In Andre's episode, we talked about realizability models without ever mentioning what they are. And so maybe could you say a few words about that?
Yes, so realizability relates, you said a certain proposition is realized by a code, which is a program or a code of a Turing machine. And I mean, this is based on this BHK interpretation of logic, that every logical statement can be realized, and this is very important in extracting programs from proofs, which is used by people like Helmut Schwichtenberg and Ulrich Berger. Their basis on realizability. Now it's subtly different to type theory. So type theory is very typed, and as the name suggests, right? Whereas realizability uses usually untyped realizers, so that's sort of programs, Turing machines, and so on. So yeah, it's related, and there are also realizability model of type theories. But there's a slight tension between them.
I would just have said it's existence on steroids. So we really mean existence. So whenever we say that, but I think actually, your version was more refined than the slogan, I guess.
Yeah, there are actually two ways to interpret existence and realizability. You can say basically there is a witness, and I don't care about it as far as the realizer is concerned. And there is a witness, and it's really part of the realizer, and you can play with this. This is difference. Yeah.
And you mentioned the BHK interpretation, and there are three OGs of constructive math in there, right? Who could you say a few more
words on that? Brauer, Kolmogorov. Yeah. Yeah, I think it goes in the same direction. I mean, it's the idea. So the question is maybe what's the difference between BHK and Curry Howard, because they go in the same direction. I mean, they all make a relation between programs and propositions, right? Yes, I think in some ways they're close enough that you really have to go into lots of historic details to tell them apart. I mean, in a way, all these things, BHK, realizability, Martin Löw, these are part of a sort of evolution of ideas which influence each other. And yeah, there is a common storyline here. And the storyline is somehow to understand logic via programs or realizers have a constructive interpretation of logic. And I think that has evolved in my view. I personally prefer the sort of type theoretic perspective where the fact that you have a realizer is not the first point. You just explain things, and the fact that they are can be realized by a Turing machine is just a sort of secondary observation. I mean, it's everything you do in the theory is constructive, and it's not surprising that you can realize them by a program.
Is it fair to say that like one half is coming from the proof theoretic side of things, so to speak, and the other comes more from like lambda calculus, computability theory, or would you say that image doesn't help? For me, that was always
it's another comment on the history. I mean, I wouldn't reduce this talk. I mean, there are different interpretation of the history and depending on your emphasis, right? So I mean, yeah, that's another good comment on these concepts.
Yeah, I maybe for now we can keep it at that, and let me allow this side remark that our podcast is at a weird spot, right? Because we are doing as advanced things as we can talk about, so to speak. So it's inaccessible sometimes, even for me. So sometimes when you talked with Andre, for instance, I had my problems, frankly, just to follow. And on the other hand,
some of accessible. The philosophical subtleties I miss on the other hand, yeah. You know, because I'm a DIY philosopher, you know. So I'm lacking lots of literature and history and quotes and so on. So I'm relying on Dennis to have all the.
Sometimes
Wittgenstein, the early and the late Wittgenstein, and how they are fighting each other. I don't know.
Yeah, that's already a spoiler for season two.
Yeah.
Great. Then the other side, we want to be accessible. We want to give definitions. Thorsten, you are doing a great job sometimes in stopping and asking for notions that are used. But we will mess it up necessarily because it's impossible to do both always. So please really keep asking these questions. It really helps us to see where we did things wrong, where the logical order of concepts wasn't clear or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's quite important. So what we try to achieve is that people who are just interested on any level can take advantage of the conversation. And so both of us, we should try to make sure that we pull down our guest to the level of ordinary models, like ourselves, right, and how the audience. But if there's something not clear, then I think it's very important and very useful if people then use the comments to ask additional questions and so on. Actually, I wonder, here is an idea which I haven't discussed in advance, whether we should maybe regularly do Q&A sessions with the audience, so like audience and have a meeting where people can join and where we can continue sort of some discussion. Maybe some of the guests would be happy to join as well, but that's maybe not essential.
Yeah, I would love that. I guess we should add an outlook part into our overview episode today at the very end to see what we can do. I mean, you also mentioned having maybe something lecture-like on type theory, and I think there are many other ideas, and I think people can also write down what they would wish for the future, maybe within About Logic, maybe adjacent. I mean, we can figure something out for a lot of things.
Yeah, please use the comments to suggest things. I mean, obviously, you can suggest guests we should invite, but also how we can, what else we can do. For example, I mean, in the moment, we are very sort of philosophical, and actually, we also post the podcast to audio only, but there's maybe a question to what degree, maybe whiteboards could be involved or not, what people think about this, and so on. So the general question about the format would be good to hear or to see.
Yeah, exactly. There's also a community tab where you can make such comments independent of concrete episodes, which is sometimes helpful because for older episodes, we don't always see all new comments. So if we missed something, it was our error. So it can happen. But let me ask you another technical term that was mentioned in the episode of Steve Awoody. Somebody asked about relative identity. Do you
know something about that? I had to look it up. I think relative identity in philosophy is that identity depends on the context. So you depending on the context, certain things are identical and maybe not identical. Maybe what you know about it, I'm not an expert on this. But I think it was somebody thought it's maybe related to Hott, which also has a different view on identity, where identity has structure. And in the moment, I think this is a different strand, I mean, a different perspective on identity. I am not seeing a relation. But if somebody has a concrete suggestion about relative identity, who we should talk about, then please put it on.
I mean, I'm wondering whether it's closer to isomorphism because things are isomorph in a given context, right? Look. But I mean, it's a delicate issue between isomorph and identity.
So, okay, maybe here's the point. I'm just thinking about it. Because in set theory, two sets are equal if they have the same elements. And this is not a notion which is this is the principle of, this axiom of axiom generality, but it follows from the idea what a set is, right? A set is basically given by a predicate. And hence, you can distinguish isomorphic sets. So the type theory is a different language, and you cannot talk about elements in isolation. That's a point I always made, right? That in type theory, elements you talk about are always typed, and you cannot just see, is there an element? So you cannot ask question like, is the empty set an element of this type? Because that doesn't really make sense. And because of this, the identity in Hott is different, or in type theory in general, since we cannot observe differences between isomorphic types. Hence, univalence sort of completes the story by saying, okay, if you cannot distinguish them, then they are just equal, because, what else are they? This is, I would say, it's but maybe my misunderstanding hit me. But I think it's Leibniz's principle of indiscernibles, right? If there are two things.
There's two things.
And they share all what you can say about them, they're equal. And maybe this could be related to this idea of relative identity, right? That in set theory, where you have, as you say, have a context, you have much more observations, the identity of sets is just this, the equality which comes from set theory. But in type theory, where you have way more disciplined and cannot express things, theorems, propositions you don't actually want to say in mathematics, and they are not expressible, but hence as a consequence, then isomorphic sets become equal, or isomorphic types become equal. This is maybe the main idea of homotopy type theory.
Yeah, that's, I mean, there are a lot of things to discuss there, right? There are these Streicher paper where the details better than I do, but some category theory angle might make some differences visible to these notions, but maybe let's postpone that for another extra episode and to talk more about Hott. I mean, there are, unfortunately, we cannot invite Streicher anymore, but there are a few people with Sadlin. Okay. Let me pass over to another question. That was the one of relative consistency. Is this also relative identity? Is this the same relative, or what to make about that?
I'm not sure. I thought it just means you have a logical theory and another one is consistent relative to this one, right? That was my understanding, but maybe there's something more subtle going on.
No, that's it. But I mean, due to Gödel's second theorem, it's all we can get most of the time. Because absolute consistency proof doesn't work.
I think that now looking back at Gödel's, I think the main theorem of Gödel is really the second one. The first one is a technical pre-play to the second one, right? You exploit the first one in the second one. First incompleteness theorem says that any theory extending a very, very weak version of arithmetic, which doesn't even include induction, if it's consistent, then it has sentences which can neither be proven nor disproven, right? So completeness here is a question that it's a very classical idea that you can either prove or disprove any proposition, right? It's interesting because that is something which is true in classical propositional logic, but it's not actually true in intuitionistic propositional logic. So it's rather unsurprising that there are statements which can neither be proven nor disproven. It's a sort of classical illusion that may be possible. But the second theorem is more important. It refers to a slightly stronger version of arithmetic, now including induction, because you use the proof of the first one in the second one, and you internalize it. And by internalizing it, you can say that any consistent theory cannot prove its own consistency. And that's a very natural statement. I mean, what do you expect? What's a logical system? A logical system is a reflection of our reasoning, of our sort of intuitive ability to reason and attempt to make it precise. Yeah. But then it's quite obvious that you believe that the system is consistent, but it's not something you can prove in the system. Somehow that seems to me, even without understanding Gödel's proof, just from a very intuitive point of view, that's quite completely natural. That would be completely weird, unimaginable that you have a theory which can prove its own consistency.
You could argue that this is easy to say in hindsight, right? But yeah. I get your intuition. It's like pulling yourself out of the mud, Rabbi.
Yeah.
Like pulling on your hair.
Münchhausen. Yes. Yeah, that is, no? Famously.
But there's a lot of nuance here. Even that provable and true are different things. It's not trivial, so to speak. We know that.
I'm not even sure, we had some discussion about whether truth is such a good notion, and my view on mathematics or on mathematical logic in particular is that mathematics, it's this storytelling view of mathematics, and hence it's not about truth, it's about evidence. So that's my perspective.
Yeah, and we had but discussion. Again, you can think like in an ideal epistemic space, you can find evidence for everything that's is there. You could have this idea.
You can say
it's like actually nonsensical.
There are complete theories. The oldest formal theory, Euclid's geometry, is complete. So if you formulate it in predicate logic, then every statement about geometry is either provable or can be disproven. Right? So you can have completeness.
Yeah, and they are also, in some sense, complex ones because it's branching out. It's not like baby arithmetic or at the very bottom. Of course, piano arithmetic is on top of that, but there are things next to it, and Euclides would be one lovely example.
Yeah, for that. I mean, the point is really the second incompleteness theorem. And the second one is like, okay, it's about a logic where we already assume that we can talk about itself, right? So this is a sort of something which emerges. You invent logical theories, and then in certain theories or in certain, I mean, what it has to make it clear, logic is nothing sort of holy or fallen from the heaven. It's a part of the human activity to make our reasoning more precise. It's an invention of humans. It's not given by any superior being, right? It's invented by people. And then we investigate our invention, right? I mean, we look at, this is meta-logic, we don't look at logic, we investigate our own invention. And then to think that our invention is sort of so good that it can vouch for itself, it seems to be an absurd idea in my view. I mean, that's all.
Yeah. At this point, we should also say thank you to our post-production team, Niklas, who's investing a lot of time making this, and I will ask him to cut out this blasphemy in post-production. just joking, of course. I see that point. But let me stick shortly longer to relative consistency. And in set theory, this is like really an industry to talk about these relative consistency results, because like this whole large cardinal things, and we will talk about this with Hemkins, is basically that, because like if you build up your universe of sets, and with a power set iteration, you get to larger sets. So the set of, maybe let's skip that detail for now. And if you want to closure that, and you get like some kappa that's already a model of everything below it, you get your problem, because ZFC cannot prove the existence of such an inaccessible cardinal. Otherwise, it would prove its own consistency, right? So, and everything on top of that will then be even more unprovable, if you want to call it like that. And weirdly, these things aren't only up in the sky. They have like real world consequences. And if you take like games on from end to end as real things, so there's some interaction there. These are the determinancy axioms. And we will talk with Hemkins about that, because there's this lovely result of him that maybe not all natural large cardinal axioms are indeed linearly ordered, which is like something as a sided assumption a lot of set theorists, I guess, share.
By the way, I mean, just to make a type-dirty comment about this.
Sure.
So we also have the counterpart of large cardinals in type theory are what are called universes. And okay, there's lots of, it would be nice actually maybe to relate the sort of set theoretic ideas of these large cardinals and provability of mathematical concepts and relate them to the type theoretic assumption of assuming that there certain universes exist.
I know there's a branch where some large cardinal notions were related to category theory, so these around Fopenka's principle. I will look it up and add it for the chat, because it's a colleague of mine who extended something there, so I should know better, but maybe I missed that colloquium meeting, but I will link something below. Great. Is there any other notion that you think we mentioned quite often and regret that we never defined it? Or do you think we should go to our look back at the episode so far?
Okay, yeah, let's do this. I can't think of anything just now.
Okay. Yeah, anything. I mean, we shouldn't say what's our favorite episode is, because all of our guests are great and we love them all equally. But maybe anyways, are there some highlights, some things that made you think longer about the topic that you want to single out? Or maybe some groupings where some episodes fit together in your eyes?
Yeah. So, we started with Kevin Buzzard, which I thought was a good start, in particular because Lean is becoming more and more
insanely quickly used, growing. Right?
Then we had this meeting with Graham Priest, which I actually wanted to challenge him a bit, and I completely failed mostly. He was very good in not engaging in my attempt to have an argument with him. I have some doubts about this whole sort of philosophical logic sort of thing. Yeah, I hated it that he subsumed intuitionistic logic under philosophical logic. But okay, let's not go back. That was from my point of view. Didn't go so well. But what was the next one?
Then we had Steve Awoudy.
Yeah, okay, that's easy for me. I mean, I thought Steve expressed some ideas very clearly, better than I can do it. But I was really pleased to him. I think it was very confluent with my own views, and obviously. We need to be careful. I mean, sometimes we want to have people we agree with, but it's also good to have people where there is some tension. And Joel was certainly, which we haven't yet published, more. And he was very happy to engage into arguments. Yeah. So, yeah.
Okay. So up next is Colin.
Yes, this was, hang on, that was a bit of a sociology of mathematics, if I remember correctly. Is it a good summary?
The good old-fashioned philosopher of math would say so, but the modern philosopher of mathematical practice would probably say these things aren't so easy to distinguish. But I mean, that was probably one of the main takeaways of the episode, right? That, well, when talking about philosophy, Colin would talk about a lot of things that others would call sociology.
I tried to push him a bit. And maybe I went too far. I think there was this criticism in the fact that intuitionism is really sort of ignored in mathematics. But I don't think that was something Colin had thought about, or so it was a bit of a mismatch when I tried to push him into this direction. And maybe I went a bit too far.
I think the difference is there's like a very descriptive stance in a lot of philosophers of mathematical practice. They would say like, even if mathematicians do something totally stupid, who am I to say that? They know better. I will keep silence about their practice and I will just think about what they are actually doing and point to things that they are not aware of
actually,
themselves.
I mean, this sort of upsets me a bit, as you may know. because I think if you want to know, if you want to study the philosophy of mathematics, the last people you should ask are mathematicians.
But it's not about taking their statement at face value, right? It's like in history. If you ask the living witnesses, you get an historical account, but it's not
the
always.
The problem to me is, so what I think is, what I would appeal to the mathematicians is to be reflective about your own practice. There are some who do this, but most mathematicians are completely blasé about this, And also, if you say something about philosophy, they run away, right? So, that is something which I find quite. It's also, not all of them, but there are many of them which are not really interested in sort of communicating outside their sort of narrow domain, and this I find disappointing. It's disappointing because I think mathematics is absolutely interesting and fascinating. And it should be presented in a way which is accessible to people who are interested, but maybe not yet know everything. And that's important sort of perspective, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there are some nuances there, but in general, I agree. I mean, it's a discipline with over 5,000 sub-disciplines, right? That's a weird situation to be in.
Obviously, it's something which is not just in mathematics, but I notice it particularly in mathematics that there is a trend. And again, obviously, there are very great counterexamples. I mean, I don't want to.
And there are even counterexamples who claim to be not counterexamples. And I guess some people know who I mean, but let's not spell that out and reopen an old discussion. Great. Then Alexander talked about tier improving and legal aspects. And we got a critical comment there that this was more like a cross examination.
I guess this is going back to my view on philosophical logic. Yeah. Or let's say epistemic logic. So in epistemic logic, there is this, or maybe philosophical logic is an attempt to actually model how people reason in reality. Whereas, I mean, what I would call mathematical logic is an idealization, is like in a way how people should reason in a precise way, right? And I'm personally interested in this mathematical logic, which via it's idealized, it's not platonic. It's just a particular way of reasoning, which tries to avoid sort of these everyday confusions and so on, because it's particularly important in mathematics. Alexander was tried to have a logic, or he's one of the people doing logics which are applicable, which are formal system, and Graham is the same, to formalize this sort of epistemic how people actually reason, and this was also a very important aspect of the good old AI, right? The good old AI in the 80s, they tried to do this. They tried to make precise what is sort of reasoning by default and so on. And going in this line is also these logics which Colin and Graham are using, which I would call epistemic logic.
Alexander, right?
Alexander, sorry. I confused you. Alexander. I'm talking about Alexander. Yeah. Sorry.
No worries.
I come from the old AI, and it was basically a failure. And maybe it's good to analyze why it was a failure, because I think this idea that you could completely model the sort of way people reason is a fallacy. It creates systems which are really complicated, hard to understand, and they're certainly not trustworthy. Because they create this illusion of precision, because you do something in a formal system, but the question is, what does it actually mean what you do in this formal system? And to me, I mean, the lesson from modern AI and these large language models and so on is that actually take it on. I mean, don't try to perfectly model it, but do the sort of statistic analysis, do something which is actually inspired by how humans actually reason. There's very context dependent. It's not pure, it's not perfect, it's not formalizable in a way, I think. The best approximations are these sort of statistical methods, and I find it a bit surprising that something like Alexander isn't of taking this on, because it seems, I mean, this is happening now, that lots of lawyers get sort of fired because they're replaced by an AI, which obviously has got some problems. But then going there and doing sort of the old AI for legal text, I find is, I mean, that was my criticism, that this was a bit out of date, basically.
Yeah, I mean, let me just make the small remark. I mean, I'm in neither case sure whether it's really about modeling our human brain with our fallacies or whatever. I think they're like, this is a very contextual work. Like for Alexander, there are parts of the law that are very rule-based, very formal, and which are also so complex that you cannot overlook them anymore. So I think the example was mergers and acquisitions in EU law or something like that. And there I think it's quite plausible that there are very strict rules that you can apply, but it's very hard to check these formalities. So in some sense, I think there might be a slightly different program. And of course, then the truth is always in the middle, mixtures of architectures, of humans and computers.
But law is, I think, always dialectic. I mean, it's always part of a conversation. And I think to really understand law, you have to know where it comes from. I mean, and what's the purpose of it. So to try to separate out some sort of formal rules, I think is not really very helpful. But that was my criticism. But
yeah, I mean, we will not find a consensus here, especially since Alexander isn't here.
Yeah, it's not fair.
So indeed. So let us move to episode 8 with Deborah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was interesting. I mean, I asked the question whether she is a Platonist, and she said no, but I haven't yet understood then exactly where she positions herself. Maybe you can comment on this.
So. Oh, I think she would say it doesn't matter in her view, because she's describing set theoretic practice, and she can do that as a Platonist or as a whatever. But her study is about the practice of set theorists. And I mean, she knows a lot of set theory, but I don't think she sees herself as a set theorist who's part of that community, so to speak. So in that sense, I think it's similar to Colin.
But she studied lots of set theory, so...
always have your...
So she was exposed to this, so... I mean, I don't think you can study something without having some philosophy about it or some idea, right? And that was my question.
I mean, that's another super interesting question, a methodological one for this philosophy of mathematical practice, which I'm doing. Because, I mean, there are some people who say, and I'm one of them, you should do a lot of math, you should enculturate yourself in that practice, and then speak about it, because then you really get the details. And on the other side, people would say, oh, no, then you are biased, then you get your opinions, you should be like observing, and let me make it very extreme, you should be like going to the laboratories and observe the wild tribe of mathematicians, note down, oh, they meet at this time, eat cake, and then they do that. And from this groundwork that's as objective as you can get, this is of course also not how anthropological work looks nowadays, right? I'm oversimplifying, but from that you can do more things, and there are great examples for that as well, for people observing as an outsider and making astonishingly impactful observations that are.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So Bettina Heinz, it's maybe one book I mentioned, it's only in German. The Innenwelt der Mathematik did such a study in the Max Planck Institute in Bonn, I think. It was super interesting.
Yeah, I guess, okay, that's an interesting perspective, obviously, and completely valid. But I'm more interested in sort of pushing forward the dialogue and reflection about mathematics and different approaches to mathematics, and I'm not, I mean, obviously I'm not perfectly neutral in this, but that's maybe it's a difference between between us and I. And it's very important also, I think, to ask these sort of innocent questions. There's this guy in BBC who is always interviewing some very sort of extremist, Louis Theroux. I don't know whether you know him. He's interviewing some very extreme people. I mean, Nazis and settlers in Israel and whatever. But he's very sort of, he's challenging them, but not by challenging their views, but he gets out that they say what they think, which is usually enough to see how absurd it is, right? But he has this ability to just sort of get them to tell him about their very racist and whatever views, and just by listening. So he's doing exactly what you want to do or are doing with respect to mathematicians, right?
Yeah, probably. So it's interesting. I will have a look. But I'm not in the UK. I should know it maybe, but I don't. Sorry.
No. Obviously, they're different cultures. So but he's very remarkable.
Okay, great. Then there is episode 9, and now you need to help me a second. Who was that? Oh, sorry, it's quite recent.
Was it not André Bauer?
Oh, right. You're right there. We had a change in schedule. He was originally for season 2, and then we moved him earlier. So it was a lovely episode. Do you want to say something?
André is a great guest and a great sort of communicator. So I think it's another of these which I really enjoyed, and you could say, okay, because we are quite close, but then we have got some subtle differences, which is hopefully interesting as well. But he's just a very, very good communicator. He gives great lectures, and he is also good in a podcast.
Yeah, I enjoyed that talk a lot. I think we need an episode more on topos theory, because it's coming up always, but it's not fully illuminated yet, I think, in this podcast. But maybe people disagree and already know enough about that. But that was just a tangent. And then let me take over for episode 10, our final episode, because there we experimented a little bit with the format. We had one moderator this time.
Usually I thought I was two. I was barred from it for bad behavior in the first attempt to.
We will also even have an episode where we have two guests and two moderator, and we will spoiler that in a second.
Maybe I should bore you sometimes. No, I mean.
Yeah, I'm actually, that's something I would like to ask the audience, whether it would be better to have sometimes the single episodes to have more things. But I'm also a fan of this because it's more fun for me having it like that. But I think in general, we will keep it to two moderators. This is not a full democratic issue here, but maybe we will kind of have a few more non-standard episodes in between. If this thing really keeps growing like that, then we can and should probably definitely invest even more time.
Yeah.
Into it.
So please spread the word and subscribe and give us some little money via this link, this coffee link. We have to buy some coffee, obviously, otherwise cannot survive. And we have
some costs, even if Niklas is giving us the more or less symbolic price for the work. And there's the software and there are some stuff. So it's not about thousands of euros. But so far it's a little minus for us. You can only run so long on a deficit. But again, season 2 will be there. It's not a donate or don't listen anymore situation. Yeah, and that was also a very philosophical one, I would say. We talked a little bit about notions or like epistemic injustice, again, a lot of relation to Colin, who was also mentioned a few times there. So that's, I guess, the rough overview about season one. And I guess I will jump back. It's only a historical footnote, but we talked about the Gödel sentences. Did you know that Gödel and von Neumann talked about the second Gödel sentence?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a lovely story, right? Do you want to tell it? Or
no, I mean, that von Neumann said to Gödel, yeah, what about basically the second theorem? Well, he realized that you can derive the unprobable of consistency from the first one. And Gödel said, yeah, sure, I know, I've thought about this. So.
It wasn't worth publishing. I mean, nowadays I would turn my whole career into that single observation if I would have made it. But back then,
I mean, the question is like, whether Gödel was completely honest, or maybe it was von Neumann who actually, I don't know.
You could never know, but I mean, I would think, I mean, there are also these arguments, and maybe we will talk about that in one of the special episodes of next season that we actually won't announce. That Gödel knew a lot of things that he didn't mention, like something forcing like with permutation models. There's always a rumor like that, but I've never looked into it. And actually, we now have the Gödel notebooks translated by Merlin Kahl, because he used a very weird shorthand. And so it was very hard to access the notebooks on Gödel so far. But that's also for the future.
Mm-hmm.
Saying that, shall we talk shortly about season two?
Yes, we should, right. So we have already some recordings. So we have, Dennis says, the two Bernhards. Maybe you can summarize this a bit better than me.
Yeah, two computer linguists or linguists who worked on the language of mathematics. So they come from the NAPROSH project that will proof checking, and they looked at math as a text, as you can look at many different texts, and also worked on some good old-fashioned frame semantics. So two lovely guests, Bernhard Fisseni and Bernhard Schröder. And there we had this two format.
Two.
As an experiment. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So then we had Ole Schreiber. So he is a very impressive guy. I mean, he's coming from mathematical physics, and he is doing some very abstract. He uses a very abstract language, motivated actually by physics, and he's using homotopy type theory to talk about stuff like quantum field theory and stuff. And this is quite interesting application of the language of type theory to do some very sophisticated high level physics where you basically if you try to do this on foot, so to say, it's impossible. So you need this sort of high level language. And Rose is very good, and he's very clear explaining these things, I think. So, maybe I feel it. maybe you don't agree.
I think he's so high up that even if he's very clear, it's very hard to follow for me at times.
Yeah.
It's really cool stuff. Yeah. And I mean, then we already spoiled it. A little bit about that. Joel Hemkins agreed to talk with us, which was very nice. And there we might even have a part two because we haven't finished all the topics. And I should mention, we listened to your advice, but back then I think we weren't aware of the thing, and you are seeing that today already, that we are fine with being a little longer in season two because people wished for that. But we will pivot to hours and hours of episodes. I mean, there are other podcasters doing that, but we won't be as strict with our 40-minute episodes in the future. Yeah, and then there are a few not fully confirmed episodes. Let me mention longtime collaborator Jose Antonio Perez Escobar, who will talk about Wittgenstein. You also mentioned that. And there we might even try to have a little presentation within the podcast as a change of pace, just to look how different things work out. And there we will look forward to get your feedback. And then to other highlights, do you want to mention them?
I mean, we're going to talk to Emily Riehl, who is quite an interesting mathematician, who's doing, is very well known for work on infinity categories. I think in my experience also very, very, she's doing very abstract stuff, but she's quite, she can explain things very nicely. So I enjoy this. And the other person in a similar direction, actually, is Mike Schulman from San Diego, who is one of the, I'm working with him, and he's one of the most clever people I know. It's very frustrating to work with somebody like this, because you shouldn't let any problems lying around. He will solve them in no time. But no, he's great, and he's also I think a very good presenter, and he's working on some project on higher observational type theory. And he's actually, as a mathematician, very unusual. He went down and implemented this on a computer, this Narira system. So that's maybe a bit of tension to the first presentation by Kevin Buzzard, who's a mathematician, who's a user of Lean, but he just uses Lean. Okay, he has got some influence, maybe, you know, on the design of Lean and the mathlib and so on. And Mike really sits down and implements a theory we have thought about, and he has thought about and implements a new system, which is quite unusual, I would say, for a mathematician.
The lines are blurry, right? I'm mislabeling you as a mathematician all the time, even if you say I'm a computer scientist. I'm sorry for that. For me, it's simply fluent. I mean, you could call Steve a philosopher, and I wouldn't hesitate to do that. And he might say, no, I'm not. At least now I'm a mathematician. But for me, it's very fluid, and it's interacting even with linguistics and with other fields, with sociology for me. And I think this is something nice about logic as a field.
Yes.
Because it's...
Sorry. I hope I'm not giving anything away when I say your family comes from Kurdistan, right? I have this analogy that logic is a bit like Kurdistan, you know? There are some parts which are in mathematics, some parts in linguistics, some parts in philosophy, some in computer science, and everywhere they are persecuted minority.
Yeah, that's some truth to that, unfortunately, I guess. Yeah, and I mean, we shouldn't stay too long with metaphors, but it's also something about drawing lines, right? If the more arbitrary you draw these lines, these disciplinary boundaries lines on a map, the more problems you will cause, right? And it's let me stay now on the scientific side of the metaphor, it's a very weird place to be as somebody being really interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary, because you always get your professorship for one chair. And on the other hand, we always want to have this interdisciplinary stuff. And I'm not sure whether there is already a framework where this is solved.
No. There are always these funding agencies they sort of emphasize interdisciplinarity. But if it then actually comes down to the hard decisions where to give the money, then it turns out it doesn't really play such a big role.
Indeed. I mean, but as a philosopher panel, maybe you would like a philosophy project rather than a 60% philosophy project, 30% mathematics, 10% computer science, and same for the other directions, right? And that's another topic. The big grants have caused a problem in the academic structure. because we have a lot of youngsters, highly qualified people, and only so many permanent positions. But I mean, that's maybe also for another episode. And it's not about logic, but about university design and governance and things like that. No, cool. Yeah, and then let's come to a slight outlook thing. So you already mentioned this idea of having whiteboard sessions, interactive things.
Actually, so for upcoming guests, there is also a secret superstar, which we will see whether it works out. So I shouldn't give away the name, but I was told by Dennis I should. but I want to create some excitement. Let's see whether it works out.
It's a historic figure. He told he's fine with being told like that. I saw a talk with him where he said you become a historic figure just by being around for too long. Great. With this hint, I would guess somebody else, which we should also invite. But that's too cryptic for the audience. There's somebody where you are close by at some times of the year. Great. So let me just invite the audience to comment what you wish for the future. There will always be a delay with the implementation because we pre-record a couple of episodes to be always sure to keep this two-week schedule. Whether you would go for a full lecture, whether this should be something for channel members, if we have something like that at some point. Exclusive content or...
Yeah, if there's interest in sort of tutorials or lectures on particular topics, that would be also interesting to know whether that would be something which we should add.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, great. Then let me use that to say thank you once again to many, many people, and I will forget some of them. So, of course, our subscribers, our listeners, our guests. Thorsten, thank you to you. And
Jan.
To Jan, Niklas, and to the Academy of Sciences for funding the first season, to the algorithm who shows us to other people, to all of those who shared us. Actually, something I was very happy about. One very friendly commentator mentioned that they shared our episodes on X. Maybe somebody will do so on Reddit. Maybe not. All fine. We will do some self-advertisement on mailing lists. But in any case, we are super happy for all the support we got. And it's really unbelievable to have a nearly hour-long podcast on formal sciences with two unexperienced hosts and have like this growth. So if we extrapolate from that, and in the first 3 months we grew by a factor of infinity because we started from zero, we will be at like very large cardinals in the next year. So that's okay. So Alex said that. Thanks you for tuning in, and see you around.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.